Last week we started a new series on the attributes of God. And attributes simply mean the character, the nature of who God is. So how do we describe and define God when we talk about who he is? And so last week, looking at Exodus chapter 3, we saw that God is this unchanging, eternal God. And so he is who he is forever and always. And he is unchangeable. You are unable to truly change the character and nature of God. And so this is actually great news for us, because it means we can read the Bible from front to back, and any promises that God makes to his people, any ways that he describes himself, we can take that and use that and say that is still true of him today. Now, we read those in context, for sure, but still, it allows us to read the Bible with hope. It allows us to read the Bible with truth and understand what reality is. And that God will always be that way. This week, as we turn our attention to the second week of the attribute series, we're going to be looking at Genesis 50. Really, we're going to be looking at, overall, at the story of a man named Joseph. And the story of Joseph actually takes up Genesis 37 to the end of Genesis in chapter 50. We're not reading all 14 of those chapters. Rather, what I want to do this morning is I want to help us see that underneath, or really behind, the backdrop to Joseph's story is the reality of God's providence. Now, providence isn't a word that you or I use every day, unless you go to Bible school, right? But simply this, when we talk about providence, what we're talking about is this: God is absolutely in control of everything. He has power to rule and to reign. Maybe sometimes you hear it talked about God as sovereign. He's a ruler. This is something that is attested to throughout Scripture. In Psalm 115, verse 3, the author actually says, "Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases." So this means that God is never surprised. Every outcome of our life is not a surprise to God. Rather, it is planned by him, and he understands it and knows that it's coming. And there's no way you can frustrate God's plan. He does all that he pleases. If there's a way you and I could frustrate God and surprise God, then we would have some equal footing with him. We would have some influence, and then therefore we could change his reactions and change his nature and character. God, as God, exists on a totally different plane than you and I. He created time. So we have to get out of this idea that God operates and thinks and lives the same way you and I do. He sees everything. And so God is completely sovereign and in control of all things. But it also means that God is working, using that power, using that control, to move everything to accomplish his good purposes for his people. And so perhaps the best verse in the Bible that sums this up is Romans 8:28, where Paul says, "We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." And he actually continues, it says in verse 29, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son." And so the ultimate good that God is working in us and for the purpose of his people is that we're being conformed, we're being molded into the image of Jesus. In our character and in our nature, that over time, the longer you trust God, the more you begin to act and look like Jesus. Sin begins to be defeated in your life. Love and joy and peace, the fruit of the Spirit, begin to grow in you and are evident. And so providence is this big word that really sums up that God is using all of his power and control and might to work everything for the good of his people and his purposes. And the story of Joseph illustrates this in a profound way. Because in the story of Joseph, all these questions that can pop up, these questions, okay, what does God do? What does that mean for the evil that's done in the world? What does that mean for the circumstances in my life that I'm not in control of, that just sort of happen to me? What does this mean for the, maybe you have a past and there have been sort of horrific sins committed against you. How is that good, God? Like, on one hand, this is a place where you should feel safe to ask that type of question. Like, if you've ever been in a church setting or religious setting where those kind of questions weren't addressed or they weren't allowed, I'm sorry for you. I really am sorry that you were ever in that environment. But first, we need to be a church where those questions are allowed and okay. Because they are. Because those type of questions are really, as you dig into them, and you use God's words, and you use the story of Joseph, God begins to give us some answers. Maybe not the full answers that we want, but he begins to see more of the character and nature of God, and he actually uses those hard questions. And what we see in Joseph's story, and what I want hope that you see in your own story, is that behind every event, there is a good God with a plan. Behind every event in your life, there is a good God with a plan for you. And just so you know where we're going, I want us to look at Genesis chapter 50, and I want to read verse 20 real quick. Before we get, this is kind of more like one of those movies where they start off at the end, and then it's like flashback 10 years later. That's kind of what we're doing. All right, I'm going to show you the end of the story, and then we're going to walk through the story together. Chapter 50, verse, I'll actually start in verse 19. But Joseph said to them, saying to his brothers, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. And so in that phrase, we see this, that Joseph says, the things that you did, you meant evil towards me. And so what evil is he talking about? Well, we have to go back about 20 years earlier. And that's where verse chapter 37 starts off. And so I would encourage you, if you have 30 minutes this afternoon, to just read Genesis 37 through 50. To read the story of Joseph, not only to check my own story, but just to allow the scriptures to just penetrate your heart. This story about Joseph and his brothers and his family is one of the most emotionally moving stories in the whole Bible. And it's in the very front. And the reason for that is this evil that Joseph is talking about happened 20 years earlier. Joseph is 17 years old. He is the youngest of 12 brothers, who are 12 brothers by four different women. So his father Jacob, known as Israel, ended up marrying four different women. And then Joseph, not only is he the youngest brother, but he's the youngest son of Jacob's favorite wife, which Jacob did not hide. Joseph's mom was Rachel. And so not only, I mean, if you grew up in a big family, you kind of understand that the more kids are in the family, the younger siblings tend to get away with more. Like, there tends to be some favoritism. Like, there's a reason the stereotype is, oh, the youngest just gets away with murder. It's absolutely true. In my family, my youngest brother says things to my dad that I would never have said to my dad and just gets away with it. Like, it's funny. To me, it would have been like, there'd been some hardcore discipline back in my day. Like, that's just the, kind of how families work over time. And so the youngest of 12, a son of Jacob's favorite wife, who just passed away, and he's very arrogant. So not only does Joseph play the role of younger brother in that he tells on his brothers when they do something wrong, so he's that tattletale kind of brother, just an annoying little sibling, but he's also this. He also has these dreams, and in these dreams, he dreams that everyone else in his family is bowing down to him. And so, of course, he wakes up the next day gloating about it. Like, even his dad is like, "Joseph, you need to be quiet." Well, one day, Jacob, his father, has sent all of his brothers out to shepherd in this field miles away. And so he tells Joseph to go check on them. And so Joseph, as he's going, his brothers see him from far away, and they're ready to get rid of him. He's been so annoying and so arrogant that they are actually plotting to murder Joseph. And the oldest brother, Reuben, steps up and says, no, let's not kill him. Let's just kind of haze him. Let's protect him. So there's a pit over here. We'll just throw him into the pit. Reuben wants to make sure that his brother gets back to his father alive. And so that's what they do. They beat him. Joseph has this really nice Technicolor coat. If you've ever heard the Broadway musical, The Technicolor Dreamcoat, he has this really beautiful coat that his dad made especially for him. They take it off of him. They strip him down. They throw him in this pit. And Reuben is off kind of shepherding, watching after the sheep while this is going down. And then this caravan of men heading to Egypt comes by. And Judah, one of Joseph's older brothers, I mean, they're all older than him, says, you know what? Maybe we won't kill him, but at least get rid of him. Let's sell him to these guys. So for 20 pieces of silver, they sell their brother into slavery. That's the evil Joseph is talking about. So at 17 years old, Joseph enters into Egypt as a slave and is actually bought by a man who is kind of a local warden, a man named Potiphar. And Joseph is a hard worker, and Potiphar notices. The Bible actually says the Lord is with Joseph, and everything that Joseph did, God made him prosper in and succeed in. And so, of course, his master knows this, and eventually he becomes Potiphar's second-hand man in the house. And as Joseph is growing, like the Bible says, he was starting to look really good, like starting to get filled out and muscular, or however you want to picture Joseph. He was a handsome dude. And Potiphar's wife wanted to get with Joseph. And there comes this part in Genesis chapter 39. Where she is trying to seduce him. And Joseph actually says to her, how can I do this great and wicked sin against God? And he runs away. But as he's running, she grabs a piece of clothing from him and has it, and then frames him and tells her husband that he tried to rape her. And so Joseph ends up in prison for doing something good. Like, he did the right thing and still ended up paying for it. And it just keeps getting worse for Joseph. Because in prison, he meets a couple of guys who were personal attendants of Pharaoh, a cupbearer, which is someone who tastes the wine or tastes whatever the Pharaoh's drinking, tastes it first to make sure it's not poison. And then the baker. And they have these dreams. And in one of the dreams, Joseph is able to interpret them. He says, God has given me the ability to interpret dreams. And so as he's interpreting the dream, he's able to tell the cupbearer, Pharaoh is going to restore you back to your place. When he does that, will you remember me? And there's this promise that he will. And then, of course, it happens and the cupbearer forgets. What we have here is all this takes place over a 13-year period of Joseph's life. 13 years of adversity. 13 years of promises being unfulfilled. 13 years of trying to do the right thing and yet never really getting ahead. Like we know what that adversity feels like. We know what it's like when people sin against us. When people seek to harm us, they seek to make our name. They seek to hurt us, either verbally, physically, emotionally. We know what that feels like. We know what it feels like to do the right thing and still feel like we're paying for it. And we know what it's like to have people promise us things, to have hope kind of out right beyond our reach and just have it snatched out. Now you and I, when that kind of adversity comes, you and I may respond a lot differently than what Joseph did. You and I, when we normally are sinned against, when we normally feel life's not going our way, the ways that we normally respond are to sin in response. And so here's what I mean by that. Like, it's the idea that the guy going through the hard breakup has every right to go on a bender. Are the girl who is getting slandered and beat down at school has every right to do the same in reverse, in return, right? This idea of I have every right to seek revenge in this moment. I have every right to rebel in this moment. And really what that is this simple response of I'm going to rebel against God and try to fix this myself. Things aren't going my way, and so if I rebel, if I choose my own path and do things my own way, then that will fix it, because God's not going to do it for me. And in my mind, Joseph had every reason to think this. Right? He's trying to do the right thing, and yet it still comes back on him. But there's also this other way that we sin in response. It's just as devious. And it's this idea of not rebelling against God, but trying to earn God's favor. So when adversity comes our way, when pain comes our way, when we are sinned against, the way we respond is to believe that God is punishing me. So I have to earn it. I have to earn His love. I have to earn His favor. So we start to look at our life and see, okay, am I going to church enough? Am I reading my Bible enough? Am I praying enough? Am I being a good enough Christian? Like, what is happening in my life? And it's this religious, self-righteous mindset that somehow God responds to your activity. Like, God is your servant. And if you feel like God's being unfair, as this really self-righteous person, you might actually start rebelling. And while both of these responses are vastly different in the way that they look, like we can tell a mile away someone who's rebelling against God, right? They're partying, they're getting drunk on the weekends, or they're just being cruel and they're being wicked, and they are, like, we can tell a mile away, like the person who's being like a younger brother, just rebelling against God. It's harder to tell someone who's trying to earn God's favor and believes that God isn't giving them what they want. And so they're just going to try harder to be good. Like, we can hide that a little better. But both of them are just as evil, because at the heart of both of them is this idea that what God's role in my life is to give me good things. God exists to give me good things. And so when God doesn't give me good things, doesn't give me what I want, I have the right to either rebel, or I need to get my act together so He'll start giving me the good things again. The truth to be believed in this moment is to believe that no matter your circumstances, no matter what has been taken from you, no matter what you have received from God, He is always with you. Your circumstances are not an indicator of God's presence. Your circumstances are not an indicator of God's presence. If you are His child, if you are a follower of Jesus, He is always with you. I mean, throughout this early part of Joseph's story and his adversity, we read references like this in Genesis 39, 2 through 4. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed. So even in slavery, God is still with Joseph. He has not abandoned him. Later, when Joseph is in prison, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Even as things went from bad to worse, God is still with Joseph. His circumstances did not dictate God's presence. There are sometimes when we think about God being providential and God providing, we have in mind what that looks like, what good things God can provide for us. And then when we don't get what we think God should give us, we get angry. We get depressed, we get fearful, and then we either rebel or we try to earn. No matter what happens in your life, that circumstance is not an indicator of God's presence, or of His favor, or of His love. One pastor says this, his name is Joe Thorne. He says, God will provide, but you can miss the provision if you're waiting for Him to give you only what you want. See, in the midst of Joseph's circumstances, what God gave him was far greater than his freedom, far greater than any material goods. God gave Joseph Himself. And Joseph had access to God and His presence at all times. And that is a glorious, gloriously great thing. Because when you know that God is always with you, that knowledge that no matter what the circumstances, He is still with me in this moment actually strengthens you to be able to honor Him in every situation of your life. I read from 1 Peter chapter 2 earlier, this identity of the church. Immediately after that, Peter says, now that you know who you are, for the Lord's sake, endure suffering. Do good no matter what. Joseph knew God was with him, and it sustained him. Joseph knew that behind every event, there's a good God with a plan. And so shortly after this, to continue in the story, it was after Joseph had told the cupbearer his dream, it was 2 years before the cupbearer ever honored his promise. The Pharaoh had come in, he had this crazy dream about 7 fat cows getting eaten by 7 skinny cows. And he's like, I have no idea what this means. And nobody can tell him. And the cupbearer's like, oh yeah, there's this guy named Joseph in prison. He interpreted my dream. He can help you with yours. And so Pharaoh calls Joseph in, and it's 2 years, 2 years that Joseph has been waiting for this man to keep his promise. And so Pharaoh tells him his dream, and Joseph is up front. Like, here's kind of what's really crazy. The Pharaoh of Egypt believes he is a god. Over and over and over again, Joseph tells Pharaoh, a prisoner, tell the guy who believes he's a god, that God alone can interpret dreams. Like, that's just a side note. Like, there's such a confidence in Joseph about who God is that he is unafraid to just tell this man who believes he's a god that the true God can interpret his dream. And that's exactly what Joseph does. The 7 fat cows are 7 years of abundance. Your crops are going to come in. You're going to have more than enough. The 7 skinny cows are 7 years of famine. Right after the abundance, you're going to have a severe famine. And Joseph actually says, you know what? If I were you, I would take the 7 good years and store all the food you can for the 7 bad years. And Pharaoh actually says, you know, it is evident that the Spirit of God is on Joseph. All right, you lead it. And Joseph goes immediately from being a prisoner to being the second in command of all of Egypt. That's crazy. Like, that never happens in our day. And then Joseph gets married. He has a couple of sons. And he actually names one Manasseh and the other Ephraim. And both of these names are means that Joseph, he names him that because Joseph is, in his mind, moving on from his past. These names of the boys mean God has blessed me and I'm moving on. Like, it is decided that I no longer have to worry about my brothers or my family. Except 9 years later, Joseph's brothers, his family, is enduring the famine. And the only nation in the local area who has any food is Egypt. So Joseph is ruling over, making decisions about who gets food, and then one day he sees his brothers come in. And now Joseph actually has power to do something. Like, think about this. Like, you have the power to exact revenge in an ultimate kind of way. You could basically eliminate your family by just denying them food. Like, he has all this power. You sold me into slavery, now it's coming back to bite you, and he can just... But Joseph doesn't do that. Instead, he doesn't let them know that he knows who they are. Instead, he starts messing with them. So he starts asking them a bunch of questions, and then eventually he ends up taking his... He finds out that there's another brother that Joseph has named Benjamin, and Joseph is from the same mom, and he's wanting to see Benjamin in his head. And so you read all this kind of in his head. And so he actually takes one of the other brothers, holds him in prison, and says, I'm not going to give you your other brother back until you bring your father and his other son back. Because Benjamin's not there. So they go back, and they finally are able to convince their father to let them bring Benjamin back with them. And then Joseph really keeps kind of playing these mind games. He lets Simeon go, but then he hides his silver cup in Benjamin's bag and frames Benjamin like he's going to steal it. And the goal there is he's going to arrest Benjamin, send the other brothers home, and keep Benjamin with him. But as he's doing this, one of the brothers, Judah, same one who offered to sell him into slavery, comes forward and says, I can't let you take my younger brother. Take me instead. And at that moment, Joseph breaks. He confesses who he is, and he laments. There's not a man in the Bible who, it says, just weeps more often than Joseph weeps during this whole situation. Like, he's trying to get revenge, but the revenge is like tearing him apart. And in chapter 45 of Genesis, Joseph says this. He says, come near to me, please. And his brothers came near. And he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been severe in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord to all his house, and a ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. Immediately after Judah is willing to offer himself, Joseph breaks, and there's this great reconciliation between him and his family. And it's like this moment of clarity for Joseph. He finally sees what God was doing in the midst of all the evil. God was preparing me to be here to take care of you. See, God had made promises to Jacob and his family that they would be a family that blessed the whole world. And by allowing them to sell Joseph into slavery, Joseph is then able to rise up to be second in command. So at this moment, when there is famine, he can be in a place to provide them with food so that their family continues to survive and exist and thrive. That's why we get to Genesis 50, verse 20, where Joseph is able to say, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. God used the suffering of one man to save many. Joseph realized God is the giver of good gifts. And he's also the God who uses all evil actions of all men for his own good purposes. Now, in Joseph's story, he gets this moment of clarity where he's able to look back and he sees all that. Some of us don't get that. Some of you are still struggling with things that happened to you in your childhood, and maybe your young adult life, things that have happened to you, happened to your family members, people you love and care about, and you have no reason or clarity on why God allowed that to happen. But what I can absolutely tell you is that whatever evil happened, God is still the giver of all good things and is still using all evil for his own good purposes. He's working that out. And he's working it out for the ultimate good of not a long life here in this world, but an eternal life in his presence forever. See, there's not one thing that you can ever have in this world that it will ever last for you eternity. So the material possessions we lose, it's okay, you can't keep them anyway. But maybe the sin against you isn't this material possession, it's an innocence that you've lost. Or maybe it's something that you've done to someone else that just is too shameful and causes too much guilt in you to even confess or talk about. What do you do with that? We can kind of wrestle with the fact that I'm not going to live in my house forever, or I'm not going to have my cars, but what about the fact that I grew up in the home I grew up in, or what about the fact that you were sinned against by people who you thought cared about you? What about those offenses? Like, how do we get there? How do we get there to where Joseph is, a man who was sold into slavery by his own family, but yet at this moment is so broken and soft-hearted that he's like, you know, I see what God is doing now. I'm going to take care of you. I think the first thing that has to happen in order to understand this is we have to understand how much we are like Joseph's brothers. We're way more like Joseph's brothers than we are like Joseph. How often have we sold God out just to get his things? How often have we betrayed and sold God out just to find a little more comfort in our life? For just a season, Lord. Following you, allowing you into my life, it's too hard right now, it's too heavy right now. I'm just going to backtrack, pull away, add some comfort in my life. How often have we done that? There's this song that I listen to nearly every year at Easter called What Have We Done? And there's this line in there. It's written by a man named Joe Day. And there's a line in there that says, Judas sold you for 30, talking about 30 pieces of silver. I've done it for way less. And it's absolutely true. I've sold God out for way less than that. I've sold God out just to save face. We're way more like Joseph's brothers than we are like Joseph. We're like Joseph's brothers in that we lie and we hide our sin. Like, they ended up telling your dad that Joseph got eaten by a bear. Like, they tore his coat up, slaughtered a goat, put the blood of the goat on there, and like let their dad believe for 20 years that his favorite son got mauled and killed by a wild animal. And in the story, when they're actually meeting Joseph, they're talking back and forth about how they feel like this is just punishment for the sin that they've hidden their whole life. Every single one of us in here are people, we just have masks on. We hide what makes us feel shameful. We hide our guilt. We hide our sin. We are more like Joseph's brothers than we are like Joseph. And just like your brothers, we try to fix it. We try to justify it. Like, if we're not going to confess our sin, at least we're going to work hard on it. They came up with a plan. They're going to tell their dad what happened with Joseph. They came up with a plan with Joseph. Like, we're just going to go. We're going to return all the money. Like, we're going to try to prostrate ourselves in front of him. And we're just going to, like, we're going to fix this. How many of us we know we're in sin, and instead of confessing it, we're going to fix it. So now when we confess it, it'll be like, I used to struggle with this, instead of I struggle with this right now. Those ways that we handle adversity, rebelling against the Lord, or trying to earn His good favor through religious deeds, we're much more like Joseph's brothers than we are like Joseph. We need to be humbled. The great enemy of trusting in the Lord's providence is our own pride. The fact that I can be in control, and that if I'm in control, then things will go exactly like I want them to go, and I'll have everything I want, and I'll have a life that I want, and I'll have a joyful life. If only I can be in control. That is pride, and it is the worst enemy of trusting in God's providence. And it's that pride that tells us that when God doesn't give us what we want, that it's okay to rebel, or it's that pride that says you haven't been good enough. We need to be humbled. We need to be humbled like Joseph's brothers, who realized that Joseph was a man who had every right and power to take their life from them, much less their own brothers. But we don't need to be humbled underneath a man, we need to be humbled underneath God Himself. See, in God's great providence, 2,000 years after this story, He sent a greater Joseph. Jesus, just like Joseph, would be sold away for pieces of silver. He would be betrayed by those He thought loved Him the most. Jesus would be put on trial and found guilty for a crime He had not committed. And Jesus would be punished, though He was innocent. In our place, the righteous for the unrighteous, the innocent for the guilty. And just like Joseph, all of this was planned by God. In Acts chapter 2, Peter is delivering a sermon, and in that sermon he says this: "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through Him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." We need to be humbled underneath the power of the greater Joseph, the one who, before we ever existed, was planned to die in your place. Like, think about the love and the love and affection and compassion of God to you, and that before you were ever born, before He ever created a thing, God planned on saving you from His sin, from your sin, by sending His own Son to die in your place. Every moment of your life has been used by God to bring you to this place of humility and trusting in Him alone, for by His grace alone. So that you would see that God is better than His things. That you would trust Him more than you would trust yourself. And more than that, because God is sovereign, because He is good, you don't need to run. You don't need to hide. You don't need to wear a mask, because the God who knows you planned before you were ever born to save you. You're free to confess. You're free to live as you are right now and be transformed by the God who is working all things for your good. He's worthy of your trust, because behind every event in your life is a good God with a plan for you. I mean, we have a great example of this in the story of Joseph. But not necessarily concerning Joseph, but concerning one of his brothers, Judah. If you remember, Judah was the brother who was the one who came up with the bright idea to sell Joseph into slavery. Immediately after that, there's this random story. It seems random, but there's a story about Judah and his daughter-in-law. Judah's daughter-in-law had married, obviously, one of Judah's sons, and he died, and so now she's a widow. And Judah tells her, I have another son. Just wait till he gets old enough to get married, and then I'll give him to you. And you can get married, and you can still be my daughter-in-law, and you'll have your children. Because in that time, children were the way you had social status. So for a woman not to have children was a horrific idea to them. The years go by, and then Judah becomes a widower. His wife dies. And so in one of the most messed up stories in the Bible, Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar, finds out that he's going to this city to look for a prostitute. And sits outside the gate, dressed as a prostitute, with a veil over her face, all that. And Judah actually hires her for the night. And she gets pregnant. And while they're together, she takes a couple of his garments and takes a couple of his possessions to have, and she keeps them. And later in the story, obviously you can't hide a pregnancy for long. And people find out she's pregnant, and they come to Judah. Your daughter-in-law has been immoral. She's had sex outside of marriage. Now she's pregnant. And Judah's response, well, let's burn her. Cold-hearted. This guy is going looking for prostitutes, and he's burning his daughter-in-law. That's his response. And so he goes to confront her, and he's confronting her, and she says, well, whoever possessions these are, that's the father. So she throws down Judah's possessions, and he immediately goes, is humbled. And his words to her are this: she is more righteous than I. And since I did not give her my own son, he didn't fulfill a promise he made to her. And it says, from that day on, he didn't know her again. He never slept with her again. It's this picture that Judah, in that moment, is humbled and transformed. And it's that very same cold-hearted man who sold his brother into slavery, who nearly burned his daughter-in-law alive, pregnant daughter-in-law alive, that God uses to reunite his family. It is Judah who is willing to take the place of his brother. The same man who sold one brother into slavery is willing to substitute himself for the other. God's providence transforms Judah's heart. But here's something that's even crazier. Tamar ends up having twins. And one of those twins is named Perez. And in Matthew chapter 1, Matthew begins his gospel outlining the ancestry of Jesus. And in Matthew chapter 1, verse 2, we read this. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez, and Perez the father of Hezron. God uses this horrific, messed up story to actually create the line that Jesus would eventually be born from. If you ever have time, read the ancestry of Jesus in Matthew 1 and just go look up the names in the Old Testament. God takes the worst incidents and makes good out of them. Behind every event is a good God with a plan. That is true not only in Genesis, not only in Jesus' life, but it's true in your life. And so the question this morning is, do we trust God's providence? When things don't go your way, do you rebel or do you try to earn your way back into God's favor? What would it look like for you to truly look to the greater Joseph, to Jesus, who has performed for you and has taken all your rebellious sin upon himself and has freed you from it? To just, in that moment, say, God, I know you love me because you did not You didn't even withhold your own son from me, and to trust him. What would it look like for us as a community to not encourage, but to really call out sinful responses? To not say, you know, that's when someone's responding sinfully, not to say, you know, that's understandable, but really to challenge that in one another. And to point one another to Jesus. What would it look like knowing God's providence to say there's not one person in my life that is too far from God to save and to grab a hold of? We have over 100 families to follow up with from our community days this summer. There are slips of paper in the back on our connection table, 5 names apiece. What if you took one of those papers and just said, Lord, in your own providence, I'm going to trust you that whatever relationships I can build with these people is the relationship that you want. I'm just going to obey and follow through. What would happen if every single one of us had that attitude toward God's providence and toward his mission? Behind every event in your life is a good God with a plan. He is for you. And he's working out everything in your life for your good and for his own purpose. Let's pray.